Hello, my name is Claire Miller and I'm the Marketing and Communications Manager at Fremantle Press. And I'm joined today by Georgia Richter, who is the Fremantle Press publisher. Hey, Georgia, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Claire, and very excited.
It is an exciting day. Why are we here?
We're here today to announce the shortlist for the 2021 Fogarty Literary Award, which is an award for writers aged 18 to 35 and brings with it $20,000 in prize money and a contract with Fremantle Press.
So what are some of the themes and things that you noticed when you were doing this year's reading?
There were 38 manuscripts in this year's award, and the thing that distinguished the manuscripts that rose to the top were that these were writers who really had a great story to tell and they had found the right genre in which to tell it. They were really confident in their delivery, so that as readers, we felt like we were in really great hands and we were excited to see where the story took us. And I think the other thing was that the manuscripts that really caught our attention were those which showed an awareness of an audience and that they were talking to someone and that they were really getting an audience along for the ride.
So first up this morning, we're going to talk to Georgia Tree. Tell me a little bit about Georgia and her manuscript and why she's on the shortlist.
So Georgia Tree is a political activist, a unionist and a feminist. She has a BA in creative writing and she also runs a feminist book club and blog. Her day job is a policy advisor to the Federal Shadow Minister for Trade and Resources. And her manuscript is a work of narrative non-fiction. And it's based on the oral history transcripts of her interviews with her dad. So it's written in the first person from her father Grant's point of view. It's almost quite novelesque in its delivery, but it's a kind of a biography of his early life, which is him growing up in a dysfunctional family and then the substance abuse that takes place during his adolescence and then his eventual redemption. What Georgia has also done is weave in a broader social history of Perth in the post-Vietnam War era. And there's a lot to do with the heroin trade there and crime, as well as social history. And I can see, looking at her biography, how many of her interests are actually playing into this. What's really moving for me, though, is how this is a daughter's, I'm almost tempted to say, memoir of her father. It's her really taking on his voice. And the writing is really muscular and masculine and singular. And for me, the way that she has gone about telling this story was really moving. The story beyond the story for me is very moving, and the sense of Grant comes through really strongly.
Well, now might be a great time to get Georgia Tree in to have a chat about her manuscript, Old Boy. So, Georgia, thank you for being with us today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Describe your manuscript, Old Boy, for us in your own words.
So it's the story of my father, essentially. It's my journey with him, learning about him and his life. It starts in his childhood, his parents splitting up and his sort of journey from there. And he ends up in prison, has an addiction battle, and then pulls himself out of it and learns to love himself and find success in work after that. And so it follows his story. And at the same time, it follows Charlie's story as a heroin smuggler and how their stories intertwine in the end. So it's kind of like, it's my dad's story, but it's also Perth's story at that time. It tells the broader story and all three of them come together in the end.
Mm. And is Charlie a real person or?
Yes. Yeah. So Brian Jeffrey Chambers is quite an infamous heroin smuggler. He got killed in Malaysia in the 80s and it caused a diplomatic incident with Malaysia. Bob Hawke called it barbaric at the time. And my dad had a relationship with him. And so he's a very interesting character. And I'd like to flesh that out in the book.
Mm. Georgia mentioned earlier in the judging report that she felt that your background has played into the writing of the manuscript. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say so. There's definitely a lot of me and my ethics and the way I look at the world in it. And that's why I loved writing it. From my dad's perspective, from first person perspective, because a lot of it was me, like, and yeah, so there's a long trail of unionism in there and social justice and things like that. But all of that I've learned from my dad. That's That's why I do what I do, because that's the kind of person he is, and they're the values that he's instilled in me.
Mm. So you think it's your dad that sort of pushed you into politics? What did you study again?
Yeah, well, I did creative writing as my undergrad, but I've my master's in international relations and national security. But yeah, my dad's been a unionist, as you can tell from the book, from his first days as an operator up north. But he's since been in the electrical trades union for the last 22 years. He's been working as a sparky. And yeah, like that was just the conversation at home. We were just talking about politics. It was all about John Howard and unfairness and what is fair and what is right. I'm so lucky to grow up with somebody like that. Everyone's his friend, and he's never had an issue with anyone, no matter what their race is, sexuality. Yeah, my values are reflected in the work, but they're as much a reflection of him as me as well.
Mm. What gave you the impetus to write it?
So I'd been studying and, as you do, making every excuse not to write. So for me at first it was like I need to give myself some parameters to work within. So it was like, I'll tell Dad's story, there you go. And then not knowing a lot about him and not knowing how amazing the story is and how much there is to be told. So he'd always sort of said offhand to me, oh, Georgia, you'll write my story one day. I'll get you to write my story one day. I don't think he ever thought I would take him seriously, but I said, sure, okay, I'm going to give myself like the discipline. I'm going to say it's going to be about Dad, and then they've got the parameters and I'll just work within it. And the more I spoke to him and the more I learned about him, it wrote itself basically. It's just such an amazing story.
And has he read the manuscript?
Not yet.
Are you worried about that?
He will be shocked, I think, with how I've portrayed some things. There's a lot of emotion in there with the family relationships, the relationship with his mother, my grandmother, who I love and respect a lot. But, you know, he had a tumultuous childhood, and you can't steer away from that. You can't hide that. So I think when he reads it back, he might be shocked. I'm probably harsher than he is. He's a very loving and forgiving person, and there's probably things that perhaps he wouldn't have seen it in the light that I have seen it, with this like harsh, unforgiving manner.
Mm. And are there things you feel that you discovered about your dad through this process that maybe even he hasn't shared with you, but that you discovered?
Like, he surprised himself by what even came out of his mouth, sort of thing. Talking about how when his mum moved away and they moved in with their grandparents, like, I think that really affected him. But it's just been that keep calm, carry on sort of mentality, and he's never really thought about it like that. And then when I sort of said back to him, oh, so she went up north but to work at a pub, like she could have done that anywhere. And it's like he twigged on, like, oh, like I just hadn't thought about it like that. Obviously, it's one of those things like opening a can of worms. I was like, do I go and interview my aunties? Do I speak to my grandmother? Like, where do I go with this? And I was like, I'm just going to talk to Dad and it'll just be his voice. So, but there's, yeah, it's this interesting ethical conundrum, because there's obviously stories that I know in the family, and it's like, do I include that? Dad didn't tell me that. Does he want that in there? And how do I deal with that? And, you know, and I think that's the interesting thing about memoir, of like truth is always someone's truth, but it's not fact, right? It's subjective and malleable. It's my version of a truth. Everyone else will have their own perspective.
Mm. So what does it mean to you to be shortlisted for the 2021 Fogarty Literary Award?
It means everything to me, essentially. I want people in the industry to see my work. Even if you guys don't publish me, if I can say my work's been shortlisted, people will be able to hear my story, and that's all I want. So I love the work, and I'm just, yeah, humbled and amazed that you like it too.
Well, congratulations. Let's give everyone in the industry a little bit of a taster from your manuscript, Old Boy.
Fremantle Prison was a limestone fortress built by convicts for convicts in the 1850s, and it had remained largely unchanged since then. I shit you not. When I got locked up, our cells were the same draconian colonial torture boxes. There was barely clean running water, no insulation to maintain warmth, and certainly no heating in the winter. It stank of shit and death. This, of course, being the place where the last man in Australia was hanged. Mum always told that story, that she only got a job at Charles Hotel because the barmaid before her had been shot by Cook, right in the arm, so she was no longer able to pull a pint. I hated sharing quarters with that particular ghost. At night, I imagined I could hear his screams. I heard the whoosh of the drop and the thumping sound of the noose. I heard wet steps with no bodies. I heard the scratching of rats against the concrete and imagined them crawling all over my skin. When I went in 1981, they put me in main division with the hard crooks. I shared a cell with this bloke Russell, who I knew from Mount Claremont. He'd gotten drunk and bashed and raped a woman at a party. He was a bit of an arsehole. He mostly left me alone, though. Old Jack was in there too. I knew him from COT, a mate of Pope's. He'd been a medic in the Vietnam War, was conscripted, sent him a bit nutty. He was a good mate to me, always happy to sit and have a chat about the war or shit on Charlie Court. I worked in the tailor shop to start with, making prison uniforms. Some of the career criminals liked their uniforms custom made, so I'd take their designs and fit it how they liked in exchange for a packet of cigarettes. One of my valued customers was the notorious Archie Butterley. He'd attempted an escape by digging a hole in the wall of his cell a year earlier. He and another bloke dug their way through the chapel and removed bars out of a window and everything, but he fell down a couple of floors and broke his foot in the process, so he turned himself in. He was in for robbing a bank and killing a guy or something. Anyway, I built up a bit of a friendship with him, tailoring his clothes. Turns out he was not simply dealing in cigarettes, the currency of choice at Frio. He was the bookie. He had so many packets that he had to store some of them in other blokes' cells, lest the guards confiscate them. The quota was 7 packs per cell, so I'd get a pack per week for hoarding some for him, and when he needed to top up, we'd meet in the yard and I'd hand it over. It was a pretty good deal. They let us pick classes, run through the university or whatever, so I decided to study English. I hadn't ever really read until then. The education officer was this American guy called Bud. He was a nice guy, full of energy and goodwill. Real American. He got me to read Catcher in the Rye. Honestly, he was probably the only person who worked at the prison who wasn't a cunt to the Aboriginal guys. Archie studied English too. He was real into poetry. I know now that it's common for drug addicts who end up in prison to continue using, that in prison it's ubiquitous. And I'm sure that was the case at Fremantle too. I don't really remember making a conscious choice to stop. It wasn't like a switch turned off in my head or anything like that. I just didn't seek it out while I was inside. I can't say I didn't ever try again. Any drug addict will tell you relapses are inevitable, and it's embarrassing as hell. But they were few and far between.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Georgia. I'll see you at the ceremony on the 2nd of June.
Hi, I'm Emma Young, shortlisted in 2019 for the inaugural Fogarty Literary Award. My tip for writers who have just got a publication deal or who are looking at getting one is start your social media marketing now. Don't wait till you've got a book deal or your book is just coming out. Start it as soon as you possibly can. Even if you feel you have nothing to share but rejection and hard work, start sharing that stuff straight away and you'll build a community around you who cares about the journey that you're going on. And that way, when you do have good news to share, your community will be rooting for you already and they'll be so excited that your book is coming out. Just take charge and build your community around you today and you will not regret it.
So let's talk about Patrick Marlborough and their novel, A Horse Held at Gunpoint.
Sure. When you hear Patrick's bio, I think it helps explain a little bit about their novel itself. Patrick Marlborough is a neurodivergent, non-binary writer, comedian, journalist, critic, and musician. And they've been published in many literary and popular journals and often write about their experiences with depression, suicide, bipolar, high-functioning autism and OCD. They live in Fremantle now alongside their incredibly naughty dog, Buckley, and a whole cast of dogs rampages through this novel, which is one of the really lovely things about it. There's a wide cast of characters who tumble through Fremantle and into Perth on public transport down to the wharf. This is a work of social satire and affectionate observation, and it features cartoons, socialism, autism, grief, martial arts. And this one, from a reader's perspective, was an absolutely wild ride. And a novel that makes you laugh aloud is a really special kind of novel. And I was sitting in my office reading manuscripts and I could hear Armel Davies laughing. And I went in and said, what's going on? And she said, I'm reading A Horse Held at Gunpoint. And it was having exactly the same effect on her. The many poignant aspects of this novel and the real kind of deep truths that you get when you're talking about subjects like depression and suicide are just cut through the whole time with this satirical edge and this humour and hilarity. And one of my favourite things about it actually is when you see the Facebook exchanges by groups who are really agitated about different things that are going on in Fremantle, like the skate park. You just recognise the world around you in this book. And it was really interesting to see, okay, the writer has taken all these ingredients. How the hell are they going to pull this off? And what is the through line here? And that's the thing that kept me reading right through to the end.
I can't wait to read this. I'm a huge fan of Frio Massive and I love seeing what people are having a good whinge about on the Facebook group there.
This novel is many things and one of it is, I think, a tribute to the capacity of Australians to have a good whinge.
And a good laugh about their whinging, probably.
Absolutely.
So let's get Patrick Marlborough in for a chat about A Horse Held at Gunpoint. So, Patrick, thank you for being here today. I'm delighted to meet you. Describe your manuscript, A Horse Held at Gunpoint, for me.
This is the question I was dreading most. Elevator pitch in my head was Joyce's Dubliners meets season 4 of The Simpsons. So it's an incredibly cartoonish, screwball, slapstick homage to Fremantle, my hometown, and the kind of literature that's written about small coastal towns in Australia, which I very much wanted to take the mickey out of. A bit of Marx Brothers and a bit of Patrick White kind of coupled in together. I'm not a huge note taker because I am a mimic and an improviser. So like once I hear it, it's just there for life. And Fremantle, of course, like it's kind of hard to not be surrounded by eccentrics and see tragedies and comedies playing out on a macro and micro level 24/7. The novel was actually improvised. I wrote it in 6 weeks. I was standing in the shower and the title came to me and I was like, that'll make a good poem. But then there was another literary prize last year, the Hungerford Prize, and it was due in 6 weeks. I was unemployed and I had just got back from New York and I was like, this is an excuse to do it. So I just sat down and started writing it.
Now, there are multiple characters in the novel. How did you choose which character to focus on?
Will, I guess, it's hard to say if he's the center of the novel. I guess he's the most autobiographical character. The image that kicked the book off was there was a kid a couple of years ago who surfed on the train in Fremantle. He stood on the train and went over the bridge, and he was him diving off the bridge. And originally, I was spinning out that story of like, what if this kid died kind of thing, and it was going to be this kind of like skater kid ghost in my head. And then as I started writing, it just kind of became me because all the other craziness I could feel is falling off. And I was like, I'm going to need something to ground it in a way. So he became the central character for that reason. Will is a recently deceased young man who has may or may not have not committed suicide and fallen off the bridge at the Fremantle Traffic Bridge and is now a ghost. And he is traveling through the book with I don't know if it's kind of spoilers, but a famous historical companion from Fremantle's past, observing the town. Midori is kind of an anime character in a way. She is an Akira-inspired 9-10-year-old leader of a child gang that loves fighting and prides herself on her ability to beat the hell out of anybody and is tough as nails and is genuinely frightening and likes to play with a butterfly knife and stuff like that. And Van and Essa are kind of archetype of the fools that go through the book and put a spoke in everybody's wheels, particularly the Ambrose, the stuffy politician character. And they kind of work as a little bit like a chorus, but also just like really a vehicle for some of the silliest gags I can really fit in there. And to me also, they are very essential Fremantle archetypes as well. And I'm speaking as someone who's been Van, especially walking around and talking guff and doing no work and skiving and pickpocketing. And that's all very Fremantle to me. Yeah. There are so many characters and I kind of came to love them all so much that it's hard for me to say which one I think is the center. I think Midori for me is maybe the most fun. She's the one that like I feel exists so completely outside of myself, even though she's maybe the most cartoonish, ridiculous character in a way, but like she's so real to me that she writes her own story. And when she appears, I'm being the most self-indulgent as a reader, where I'm like, oh, I'm about to have fun because I like exactly all the silliness that she is. Mm. Van and Esther are probably the most like my comedic writing style and like what I'm very used to. I like writing dialogue and I love Rosencrantz and Guildenstern type, just absolutely pointless know-it-alls who know nothing. They're my favorite kind of character to write.
So many questions. Georgia was talking earlier. She said she wanted to know whether you did martial arts yourself.
Obviously very realistic. Georgia has met me and she should know that I wheeze when I walk up a hill. No, I'm a huge fan of martial arts movies though. I am a big anime nerd. I'm obsessed with the form, and Fremantle is a fighting town to me. Like it used to be a lot rougher than it is, but when I was a kid, it was like you were guaranteed to see fights every day. And the fight in the novel that takes place in CBC Oval, like going to JC, the thing every day was like fight on CBC Oval after school. There'd be some event match between two school bullies or whatever. And I kind of liked the mythopoeia of like Street Fighters and the way people talk themselves up. And the huge rift in reality usually between when somebody in Frio wants to fight and then you're watching two like middle-aged drunks just kind of fall over each other and it's very quiet and awkward. You've got the kind of villain who's internalized this stuff and toxified it into an actual state of real violence. And this little girl who has imbibed all these cartoons and has got this preternatural talent for it. And so like, what if you took these street fights and made them hyper-competent?
And you've mentioned growing up in Fremantle.
Yeah.
And it seems like the novel is a bit of an ode to the 90s, would you agree?
Yeah, it's definitely rooted in nostalgia for Fremantle, but I think also Fremantle's whole thing is that it's always trapped in its past, and it's always stuck between the past and the future. It's a real purgatory town. It is a town that's always caught between nostalgia for its like mythic working class past and the kind of artists and characters that pass through it, and then the reality of it's very like gentrified, stultified, nothing much to do, not much opportunity, now full of SUVs and... And as much as it is about Fremantle in the 90s, like Fremantle now is not so different from Fremantle in the 90s, with the obvious exceptions of things that have changed, like social media and stuff like that. I think the hilarity of this town is, for all its talk of change and its attempts to change, it trips over itself constantly. My mom's family have lived in Fremantle for generations. You know, I've lived here my whole life, other than living in New York off and on. So I've grown up in this constant state of like anecdotes about the town where it's still talked about like it's the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, depending how old they are. My dad, if he gives me directions, he'll say, oh, it's by the tire shop on so-and-so. I'm like, Dad, when did that store close down? He'll be like, ooh, 1981. I'm like, yeah, I was born in 1990. I have no idea what you're talking about. But that's how they talk. So you live in all these eras at once kind of thing.
Yeah. You've got a dog.
Yes.
Called Buckley. I saw that in your bio. Are we going to trip over each other at the dog park in White Gum Valley?
People keep asking me if like Iron is based on him, and I'm like, Iron's a good boy. Like, Buckley is bad.
Yeah. You've got heaps of dogs in the book, yeah. And I want to talk about the dogs in the
yes.
book. Yes. But you're saying Buckley is not in the book.
I think in my head when I first started writing Iron, he looks like Buckley, because Buckley's very handsome, but Iron's all white. Buckley's got the spots and stuff. When I went through, I was like, oh, he really isn't in here, which is kind of funny, because he is 2/3 of my day is spent with him. I think if I do another edit and rewrite, I'll work in a line at least. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So tell me about the dogs in the book.
Okay. Well, I love dogs. I'm on the autism spectrum, and I find it a lot easier to hang out with dogs than people. Dogs have always gotten along with me very well. They come up to me at parties. I come up to them at parties, tend to drift together and sit in a corner together. And I've always had a very good connection with just about every dog I've ever met. And I think Fremantle is a dog town. Like, especially if you're making fun of NIMBYism, like the book is, and yuppies and stuff like that. And just, you know, like idiots. I think nothing brings it out of people like their dogs. Like, it's the people that aren't aware of it. It's something very comical about the dog park. It just, the politics, the cliques, the way people interact with each other around these animals that are completely indifferent to that kind of stuff. I always feel like the dogs have their whole other world going on. So obviously with the book, I've taken that to its extreme. To me, like, dogs are innately good. And so Iron kind of became a vehicle for a lot of the political writing in the book, because the revolutionary is not this old guy in a Maoist hat, you know, who used to be a stevedore anymore. But I have this deep nostalgia for that kind of revolutionary. So through Iron and through the Dogs, it's like, what if you could have this kind of almost noble revolution? Like, who are the perfect politicians? Because humans are so flawed. So it was like Dogs to me. And of course, the irony is that in the book, it's not flawless. They have their own problems and factions and whatnot.
Yeah. So we're talking about comedy.
Yeah.
And you're a stand-up comedian. Is that what you're doing in New York when you're going back and forth?
Yeah, I was doing stand-up there. When I first moved there in 2017, I moved into this very strange building that's an old doll factory from the 20s and now is this illegal punk loft that's been there for 30 years, a hallway full of graffiti and skateboarders, and sounds like something I would have sought out, but I actually found it by accident. Immediately became best friends with my roommate. Our apartment's kind of like a recording studio, so I'd stay there and live this, like, very, I guess, bohemian life in a way. Bohemian, but, like, very homey, like, very community, very close-knit set of people while performing in this, the alternative comedy scene, which over there in Brooklyn at the moment is, like, probably the most exciting scene in the world for the people that it's putting out. A lot of my friends in the last few years have gone on now to have movies and TV shows just in the last year. And it was very humbling and inspiring to, like, be around, like, such talented people and kind people and such a diverse comedy scene. But yeah, I was there mainly doing that and writing and recording music.
Yeah. So what does it mean to you then to make the shortlist of the Fogarty Literary Award?
I mean, it's literally a dream come true, and I wish I had a less cliche way of phrasing it. With autism and the kind of like hypomanic person I am, where it's like I can't shut up, clearly. And it's that thing of like craving permission to not shut up. And what the short list is to me is like, it's permission. Like, it's permission granted to keep talking and to keep writing. You know, I read a lot of Australian fiction and I love it for the most part, but it is, it can be very dour and silliness is not permitted. So what the short list means is that I can be goofy and I can have this very spectrum-y silliness, which I've worked to repress in a lot of ways. And now, like, I'm very excited to sit down and write the next things, you know?
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What an amazing achievement. And now you're going to read chapter one from A Horse Held at Gunpoint.
Yes. Okay. Chapter one, You're a Ghost. The first thing I decided to do as a ghost was stand on the railway tracks and let a train pass through me. I floated up from the water where I landed with a plop. I looked down at the pylon that I'd struck my head on. There was a splatter of blood, like something out of a comic book. I could see my lifeless body bobbing beside it. It was then that I decided to stop looking down and start looking up. I got that I was a ghost in an instant. I got it. I've read ghost stories where there's some umming and ahhing on the part of the newly deceased as to their ghosthood, but not me. I got it. As you float over your corpse, spot your own blood, pass through a series of beams, and come to stand on the bridge from which you just plummeted, you'd be mad to think you were anything other than a ghost. I had never believed in ghosts before this instant, but I could admit when I was wrong. I was living proof, so to speak. I'd been a ghost for 2 minutes at this point, unless the Fremantle-bound train bearing down on me was running a few minutes late, as it sometimes did. I stepped in front of it. It felt like swallowing a doll's house. I could see the bags under the driver's eyes as I passed through his cabin and onto the carriages. I did as I'd always done when stepping onto the Fremantle line. I looked for friendly faces. I saw a man holding a lime tree sapling. 10, with a split lip and bleeding shins, bouncing her skateboard on her knees. There was a famous author sitting in front of a poster for this weekend's big festival. The homeless conductor, known locally as Spoons. A plump woman faking a phone call. In the second carriage, I saw a small boy dressed as a cowboy firing a plastic gun into his mouth. Fat Charlie picking at bits of napkin that had stuck to his sweaty forehead. Tom the barrister with the X-shaped scar on his chin. A transit guard combing through his spiral notebook. A young woman in a subway uniform lifting her shirt to her nose and sniffing disapprovingly. That teacher who always slurred his words. Van and Esther, who were shelling peanuts and saying, "Good time to invest in lithium. I'll make some calls." In the final carriage, I saw Marianne reading a book about Rembrandt. A white dog wearing a red neckerchief sitting perfectly still. Against the back door was an old man with a nosebleed, holding a pair of work boots, humming, "Oh, Christmas tree," loudly. As he passed through me, lines from a different song caught in my head. "When cowards flinch and traitors sneer." I'll admit that I flinched as I came out the train's rear. I get that I'm a ghost now, but change has never been my strong point. I glided over to the harbour side of the bridge and looked out at my favourite cargo ship. I waved at the crewmen leaning over the rails. I knew they couldn't see me. It was just a habit I picked up from my mother. She said it was important to wave at the ships as they came and went from the port. Wave. Welcome to Fremantle. Wave. Goodbye to Fremantle. One of them was pointing at something in the water. I waved. The sun was setting. They can't see you. A man on horseback appeared beside me. He looked like some sort of cowboy, if a more authentic one than the small boy I'd seen on the train. I know that, I said. You're a ghost. People can't see ghosts. He dismounted, and the horse vanished into thin air. I know that, I said. But it's good to wave. Give them a wave. He looked at me with dark eyes, his hands in his vest pocket. He took one out and waved at the crewman. One of them waved back. My new friend flinched. He said, How came you dead? By being a major dickhead, I told him. I see, he sighed. You were military. Nah. How about you? How'd you cark it? Neither of us looked at each other. We were both still waving at the harbour. I rode my horse into the sea and shot myself. Oof, I said. Double whammy. Double whammy? He paused for a second. Ah, yes. Double whammy. He looked back at the river behind us. Are you very confused? He asked me. Nah, I said. I get it. Hey, I noticed he'd stopped waving. Wave! Wave goodbye! Goodbye to the ocean, the ships, the fishermen, the gulls, the traffic. The noise of the living port was drowned out by the next train.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for your reading and thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I look forward to catching up with you on the 2nd of June at the ceremony.
Yes, I am incredibly anxious.
Hopefully not long now, not much longer to wait.
Yes, thank you.
Hi, my name's Michael Burrows. I'm the author of Where the Line Breaks. And if there's one thing I wish I had known before I was shortlisted for the Fogarty or before my book came out, I wish I'd known how much support I would get from my fellow authors and how many new friends I would make along the way. Writing can be such a solitary practice, but the publishing process is anything but. There are so many wonderful people, so many wonderful fellow authors who are here to support you and help you, and it's an amazing experience. So my one piece of advice would be to get to know your fellow authors, you know, follow them on social media, like their posts, read their books and talk about their books, because everyone's dealing with the same issues and everyone can help each other out along the way.
So Brooke Dunnell is the author of The Glass House. Tell me a little bit more about her.
Brooke Dunnell is a short story writer, and her short story collection, Females and Dogs, was a finalist in the 2020 Carmel Bird Digital Literary Award. She has also had short fiction published and recognised in awards around Australia. Brooke has worked as a creative writing mentor and workshop facilitator, and she has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Western Australia. She lives in South Perth. The Glass House really surprised me, actually, because it begins with a 36-year-old woman called Julia who decides she needs to go back to Perth to help pack up her dad's house to help him move into care. We get the sense from her life in Melbourne that her marriage is on the rocks. She has a good relationship with her stepdaughter but is ambivalent about continuing her relationship with her husband, Rowan. And off she goes. And I thought, okay, this is going to be one of these pack up your house kind of novels, which is quite a familiar trope. But there is surprise after surprise when she arrives. A dog has moved into her dad's house, for starters, and Julia thinks the dog is there because her dad has put that up as an obstacle for why he can't possibly move. And quite early on, she also runs into her old school friend, Davina, who you think, Davina will be here to support her and help her through this time. And it's actually the twists and the emotional depth that the novel drops into that really give it its colour and its forward momentum. And the other thing that's really unnerving in this novel is the bad dream she begins to have about her stepdaughter while she's in Perth. And it's a novel ultimately that's very affirmatory about the sorts of extended, unexpected families we build around us and the emotional connections that we have, and how sometimes you can have put the past behind you in a way that needs resolving even though you don't realise that it does.
So Brooke, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about your manuscript, The Glass House.
It centres around a character called Julia, and she's about 36. She's come to this kind of crossroads in her life where kind of everything in her marriage is stalled. She doesn't really know what to do next. So at the beginning of the novel, she travels from her new home in Melbourne to go and stay with her really ageing father in Perth, and to help him move into a nursing home. He's finally agreed to go to a nursing home. And so while she's there, she's got these difficulties of moving her dad around. She bumps into this old friend from childhood who kind of seems to have nefarious intentions after a while. And then at the same time, she's having these kind of really weird, stressful dreams about her stepdaughter who's back in Melbourne. She doesn't really know what to do with them.
So she bumps into a childhood friend, and childhood bullying seems to be a central part of your work. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it's that kind of bullying where you're friends but you also bully each other. So it's that young girl, kind of 10-year-old, they're starting to figure out their place. They end up in a three-way friendship eventually, and so it's always two against one. It's one of those things where at the time the main character and I think the other characters, they don't realise they're bullying each other. It's just like a power thing going on. And then it's only later, especially when Julia's got this stepdaughter who's a bit older than that and seeing female relationships, and she's kind of reassessing and going, oh yeah, actually this is bullying. It's not actual friendships. Friends don't behave this way.
Mm. Yeah. So she's looking back, but she's also got her stepdaughter.
Yeah.
So tell me about the stepdaughter. What are these dreams that she's having about the stepdaughter?
So her stepdaughter's 14 at the time, so she's a bit older than Julia was when the bullying relationship kind of started. And she starts having these dreams about her stepdaughter being on a bus at the start, and that there's just this older male presence. She can't see it because it's a dream, you know, but she knows the guy's there. So the stepdaughter's name's Evie. He starts telling Evie, you know, we know each other, I know you, you know. And Evie's got this kind of feeling where she doesn't want to see this guy, but she does, like likes the attention. And then it kind of goes from there. And so Julia's quite concerned but doesn't want to ask about it because, you know, dreams are, you know, she doesn't think they're prophetic or anything, but she really feels like something bad's happening to her stepdaughter back in Melbourne, and there's nothing she can do about it.
And it really looks at that power imbalance between adults and teenagers. Is that correct?
Yeah, especially also when you're a teenager yourself and you kind of feel like you've got power. So when Evie's meeting with this guy or hoping to meet with this guy and she thinks they're friends, you know, to someone like Julia, no 14-year-old girl is friends with an adult man. But Evie's got that feeling of being chosen, of giving her attention, someone wanting to meet up with her. And so she feels like there's that kind of push and pull that it's a good thing, bad thing. But the adults know, no, it's a bad thing. Mm. Yeah.
The other theme that comes out in your writing is about fertility.
Yeah.
And surrogacy. And again, another power play between two women. How does that work?
So the friend that she bumps into at the supermarket eventually kind of offers to her, I could be a surrogate for you, because one of the things that's going on with Julia and her husband back in Melbourne is they've had all these years of infertility. They're really stuck in it. They're also not facing it. They don't really talk about it. They don't seek help. They just continue to not have this baby that they think they both want. And so this friend Davina, who she's bumped into, is kind of like, well, I've had kids before, I could be your surrogate, which is this kind of, at first Julia takes it as like, oh, you know, that's a nice offer, doesn't really take it seriously. And then Davina kind of persists with it, and Julia starts to think about, oh yeah, what would it be like if I actually took her up on this offer? And then in this situation, because I know actual offers of surrogacy are very altruistic and, you know, people would obviously only do them if they really care. But in this instance, in the novel, she's just trying to have that power play, like, I can have a baby for you, you'll owe me something, I can give you the life you want. And then meanwhile, Julia realises as the novel unfolds that she doesn't actually really know anything about Davina and about her adult life. And, you know, would you really want someone to carry a baby for you and you don't really know what's going on with her? So that's kind of like the power issue that comes into it.
Mm. So you've put all these different threads.
Yeah.
How did you go about bringing them together into a single narrative?
I don't know, somehow. Because actually I'd had a different manuscript that had a woman who was suffering infertility. In that novel, her mother had actually died and she was sorting out her house. And the novel was kind of, it was okay, but it was kind of limp. Nothing was really happening. And I was like, I like that idea, but, you know, nothing's happening in this story. And then I'd had these thoughts about the surrogacy thing as being a separate story, a kind of like thrillery kind of thing where someone would get involved in this surrogacy relationship and it would all not be as it seemed. And then also I was thinking about teenage girls, how they interact with adults and stuff. And I don't know when or where it was, but somehow I just thought I could make all these part of the same story, you know. And that's when it started to really kind of unfold the way I hoped it would.
So we've talked about your female characters.
Yeah.
But there's also a father figure who's very central.
Yeah.
Tell me how that fits into the narrative.
Julia, obviously she loves her father. He's got a lot of caring qualities. He was a really good father, but as an old man, he says he'll move into a nursing home and then he starts to have second thoughts. There's things he's keeping from her. He's this 92-year-old, difficult, stubborn kind of guy now, but spending so much time with him in their family house, she's thinking about him when he was a father, when she was younger, what he's done for her, the kind of role model he's been, and he knows how to treat teenage girls. He's what you want out of a father, that whole situation. He's got the right kind of perspective on it.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, so you've got all these different threads.
Yeah.
They're all running through your head. The Fogarty Literary Award call for entry comes out.
Yeah.
What happens next?
I think I will be 35 the week after that finishes. So this is like almost a sign. I'm a Perth writer. The book is largely set in Perth. I know that the last time the Fogarty was held, even if you didn't win, the authors did really well. It's really well regarded. And I just thought this is a good chance because I'm not necessarily a finisher of story ideas, and I'll kind of finish a first draft or get to the end of a first draft almost and give myself second thoughts. But the really good thing about the timing with the Fogarty was, I think once I kind of figured out when it was due, I had 3 months. That was a really good time to finish the first draft, revise it, proofread it, get it in, and not tell myself not to bother. So yeah, I think it just all kind of fell into place. Yeah.
And did you have readers in that 3 months or has it come to us?
It's come straight to you, yeah. So usually I would have readers. That would be my preference. But because I came down to the wire with getting it in, I think I sent it in the day before the due date. And yeah, and the fact that this was the last year I could enter it. And if I'd timed it better, I would have readers. But I thought, I know it's at least proofread, they'll read it, and if it's bad, they'll know that it was bad.
And it clearly wasn't, because you're shortlisted. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
So what does it mean to you to get on a shortlist like this?
Especially not having had readers for this particular manuscript, the recognition that I can kind of trust myself and that I did do something that professionals who have real experience can look at it and say that, yeah, this is one of the top entries that we had, is so confidence boosting. It's so gratifying. It's, it just gives you a little bit of, oh, okay, I do know what I'm doing sometimes, at least this one time. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
We are delighted to have the manuscript and
Thank
we
you.
Really love it. Are you able to read us something from it?
Yes. So this is the day that Julia gets back to her childhood home in Perth. And so when she arrives, she actually kind of flakes out on the bed in jet lag, and this is when she wakes up afterwards. The afternoon passed in long scattered dreams like clouds, and when Julia woke, it was dark. There was no lamp in the guest room, so she had to find the light switch blinking against the brightness. Her stomach felt gnarled. She had no idea of the time, but she'd last eaten a dry aeroplane croissant very early in the morning. Opening the bedroom door, the light spilled out into the hallway, showing the treacherous route to the back part of the house, a clunky telephone table piled with old yellow pages, crushed sneakers lined up along the skirting board, a mat with its corners curling at the entrance to the kitchen. How did her father navigate this obstacle course every single day? Guessing that she'd wake hungry, Don had left a cling-wrapped plate of cheese and crackers on the bench. Julia ate it all, tapping the last knob of cheese along the porcelain to suck up any last crumbs. When she was finished, she took the plate to the sink, found a plastic cup and filled it with tap water, draining it in a few deep swallows. The back third of her childhood home had full-length windows that looked out onto the backyard. The night was a deep grey, but Julia could make out the terracotta bricked patio and lawn beyond, both of them dry and bare. Right near the back fence was the old Hills hoist, drooping to the right from when Paul used it to play Superman. Squinting, Julia saw a couple of items pegged out there, spinning slowly in the dark. Footsteps tapped their way down from the front bedroom. Her father had always slept light. Julia shook her head. The dull tech sound of the stick was missing, meaning Don had risked a trip through the house with nothing to break his fall. Turning to face him, she put her hands on her hips and opened her mouth. A dog stood there, peeking its snout into the kitchen. It was mid-sized with a deep brown coat. Seeing her, its tail waved. It walked over to the breakfast bar and sat down, panting gently. "Dad doesn't have a dog," Julia thought, then reconsidered. "No one told me Dad got a dog." "Hey, mate," she murmured, offering the animal the back of her wrist to sniff. It licked her arm gently and she took a hold of its collar, bright yellow with a paw-shaped tag. "Biscuit," she read. Thrumming its tail in recognition, the dog reached up with its front paws and revealed himself to be a boy. "Well, there you go." Scratching his jaw, she wondered where Biscuit had been when she got there, then remembered her father standing in the entryway with his bedroom door shut tight. Straightening, she checked the clock and groaned. It was 11:30 at night and she felt wide awake. If she'd felt intimidated by the endlessness of time earlier in the day, then it was much worse now, with the light gone, the silence, the appearance of a random dog. Despair sucked at her like the undertow of a wave. This was all too much, too much. No, too big. The house was too big. That was the beginning and the end of the problem.
That was Brooke Donnell reading from her manuscript, The Glass House. Thank you very much, Brooke.
My name is Rebecca Higgy.
This is my tip for the winner. Your work has only just begun. There is so much work ahead of you in the editing process. But I'd encourage you to take that excitement that you felt when you were first shortlisted, take that excitement from winning and use it when you edit your book. Your editor is your champion. They picked your book for a reason. So go into all of those meetings with your editor with joy and excitement. Because if you do, you're going to produce a book that is even better than the book that won the Fogarty.
These are three writers to watch, and I can't wait for the announcement on June the 2nd in the Spiegelten at ECU. If you want to find out who's won, come along.